Chapter 21. As the sun rose, the Oregon bounded across a calm sea under clear skies at a speed of 30 knots. With her ballast tanks pumped dry to raise her hull out of the water to reduce drag, she made a strange sight with her stern dug deep in water thrashed white by wildly turning screws, her bows lifted nearly free of the troughs before bursting aside the crest of the next rolling swell. During the night, the cargo deck had been cleared of debris while the ship's surgeon worked nonstop to bind wounds and operate on those who were seriously injured. The Oregon lost only one man, who had the misfortune of being struck in the head by fragments from the 100-millimeter shell when it smashed into the upper section of the stern. None of the wounded were critical. The surgeon also managed to save all but six of the Chinese Marines. Both officers had died and were dropped over the side with their men who had not survived. The women who served aboard the Oregon quickly turned into angels of mercy, assisting the surgeon and tending to the wounded. Pitt's unlucky curse held tight. Instead of an attractive nurse to bandage his hip wound, his luck of the draw was the ship's quartermaster, or mistress. Her actual title in Cabrillo's corporate structure was Supply and Logistics Coordinator, who stood 6 feet and weighed 200 pounds if she weighed an ounce. Her name was Monica Crabtree, and she was bright and resourceful as they came. After she finished, she gave Pitt a slap on his exposed tail. "All finished, and may I say that you've got a nice set of buns." "Why is it?" Pitt said, pulling up his boxer briefs. "Women always take advantage of me." "Because we're smart enough to see through that steely exterior and know that inside beats the heart of a sentimental slob." Pitt looked at her. "Do you read palms? Or, more correctly, buns?" "No, but I'm a whiz with tarot cards." Crabtree paused and gave him a come-hither smile. "Come over to my quarter sometime and I'll give you a reading." Pitt would have rather rushed off for a root canal. "Sorry, knowing the future might upset my stomach." Pitt limped through the open doorway to the chairman's cabin. No bunk for the chairman of the board. Cabrillo was lying in a king-size bed with a Balinese-carved headboard on top of clean green sheets. Bottles on a stand containing clear fluids flowed into him through tubes. Considering his ordeal, he looked reasonably healthy as he sat propped up by pillows, reading damage reports while smoking a pipe. Pitt was saddened to see that his leg had been amputated below the knee. The stump was elevated on a pillow, a red stain having spread through the bandage. "Sorry about your leg," said Pitt. "I had hoped the surgeon might have somehow reattached it." "Wishful thinking," said Cabrillo with extraordinary grit. "The bone was too shattered for the doc to glue it back on. I guess there is no sense in asking how you feel. Your constitution seems to be firing on all cylinders." Cabrillo nodded at his ming limb. "Not so bad. At least it's below the knee. How do you think I'll look with a peg leg?" Pitt looked down and shrugged. "Somehow I can't picture the chairman of the board stomping about the deck like some lecherous buccaneer." "Why not? That's what I am." "It's obvious," Pitt said, smiling, "that you don't need any sympathy." "What I need is a good bottle of Beaujolais to replace my blood loss." Pitt eased into a chair beside the bed. "I hear you've given orders to bypass the Philippines." Cabrillo nodded. "You heard correct. All hell must have broken loose when the Chinese learned we sank one of their cruisers along with its crew. They'll use every arm-twisting scheme in the diplomatic book to have us arrested and the ship impounded the minute we sail into Manila." "What, then, is our destination?" "Guam," answered Cabrillo. "We'll be safe in American territory." "I'm deeply sorry about the death and injuries to your crew and damage to your ship," said Pitt sincerely. "The blame belongs on my shoulders. If I hadn't insisted you delay your departure from Hong Kong to search inside the liner, the Oregon might have gotten clear." "Blame?" Cabrillo said sharply. "You think you're the cause of all that's happened? Don't flatter yourself. I wasn't ordered by Dirk Pitt to covertly search the United States. I made a contract with the U.S. government to fulfill a mission. All decisions relating to the search were mine and mine alone. You and your crew paid a high price. Maybe so, but the corporation was damn well rewarded for it. In fact, we're already guaranteed a fat bonus. Still hell. The mission would have been a bust if you and Giordino hadn't learned what you did. To someone, somewhere in the hallowed halls of our intelligence agencies, the information will be considered vital to the nation's interest. All we really learned, said Pitt, is that a former ocean liner, gutted of every non-essential piece of equipment and owned by a master criminal, is sailing without a crew to a port in the United States owned by the same master criminal. I'd say that's quite a store of information. What good is it if we've yet to fathom the motivation? I have confidence you'll divine the answer when you get back to the States. We probably won't learn anything solid until Chin Shang tips his hand. The Ancient Mariner and the Flying Dutchman had ghostly crews. Yes, but they were works of classic fiction. Cabrillo set his pipe in an ashtray. He was beginning to look tired. My theory about the United States blowing up the Panama Canal might have held water if you'd found her bowels filled with high explosives, like the old Lend-Lease destroyer during a commando raid at Saint-Nazaire, France, in World War II, said Pitt. The Campbelltown, I remember. The British packed her with several tons of explosives and rammed her into the big dry dock at the Saint-Nazaire shipyard so the Nazis couldn't use it to refit the Tirpitz. With the help of a timing device, she blew to pieces several hours later, destroying the dry dock and killing over 100 Nazis who came to stare at her. You'd need several trainloads of explosives to blow a ship the size of the United States out of existence and everything within a mile around her. Chin Chang is capable of most anything. Could it be he got his hands on a nuclear bomb? Suppose he did, suggested Pitt. What's his upside? Who'd waste a good nuclear bomb unless you've got a target of conspicuous magnitude? What could he gain by leveling San Francisco, New York, or Boston? Why spend millions reconverting a 990-foot ocean liner into a bomb carrier when he could have used any one of 1,000 old obsolete ships? No, Chin Chang is not a fanatical terrorist with a cause. His religion is domination and greed. Whatever his grand design, it has to be devious and brilliant, one that you and I wouldn't have thought of in a million years. You're right, Cabrillo sighed. Devastating a city and killing thousands of people is a no-win situation for a man of wealth, especially when you consider that the bomb carrier could be traced back directly to Chin Shang Maritime. Unless, Pitt added. Unless. Pitt gave Cabrillo a distant look. Unless the scheme called for a minimal amount of explosives. For what purpose? To blow the bottom out of the United States and scuttle her. Now there's a possibility. Cabrillo's eyelids were beginning to droop. I do believe you may be onto something. That could explain why Al found all the doors to the crew's quarters and lower cargo holds welded shut. Now all you need is a crystal ball to predict where Chin Shang intends to sink her, Cabrillo murmured softly. His voice trailed off as he drifted off to sleep. Pitt started to say something, but saw that he would only be talking to himself. He quietly stepped from Cabrillo's cabin and softly closed the door. 3 days later, the Oregon picked up the harbor pilot, passed through the shipping channel, and slipped alongside the dock at Guam's commercial terminal. Except for the stump where her aft mast once stood and her pulverized stern, the ship looked little the worse for wear. A string of ambulances was waiting on the dock to receive the wounded and transport them to the hospital at the island's naval station. The Chinese Marines were the first to be taken away, followed by the ship's crew. Cabrillo was the last of the injured to leave the ship. After saying their goodbyes to the crew, Pitt and Giordino muscled aside the stretcher-bearers and carried him down the gangway themselves. "I feel like the Sultan of Baghdad," said Cabrillo. "You'll get our bill in the mail," Giordino told him. They reached the ambulance and gently set the stretcher on the dock before loading it onto a gurney. Pitt knelt down and stared into Cabrillo's eyes. "It was an honor knowing you, Mr. Chairman." "And a privilege to work with you, Mr. Special Projects Director. If you ever decide to leave Numa and want a job sailing the seven seas to exotic ports, send me your resume." "I don't mean to criticize, but I didn't exactly find the crews aboard your ship a benefit to my health." Pitt paused and looked up at the rusty sides of the Oregon. "Sounds strange to say so, but I'm going to miss the old boat." "Likewise," Cabrillo agreed. Pitt looked at him questioningly. "You'll mend and be back on board in no time." Cabrillo shook his head. "Not after this trip. The Oregon's next voyage is to the scrapyard." "Why?" asked Giordino. "Are the ashtrays full?" "She's outlived her usefulness." "I don't understand," said Pitt. "She looks perfectly sound." "She's been what is called in the spy trade compromised," explained Cabrillo. "The Chinese are wise to her facade. Within days, every intelligence service around the world will be on the lookout for her. No, I'm afraid her days as disguised gatherer of classified information are over." "Does that mean you're going to dissolve the corporation?" Cabrillo sat up, his eyes gleaming. "Not on your life. Our grateful government has already offered to refit a new ship with state-of-the-art technology, bigger, more powerful engines, and a heavier weapon system. It may take a few operations to pay off the mortgage, but the stockholders and I are not about to close down operations." Pitt shook the chairman's hand. "I wish you the best of luck. Perhaps we can do it again sometime." Cabrillo rolled his eyes. "Oh, God, I hope not." Giordino took one of his magnificent cigars and slipped it into Cabrillo's shirt pocket. "A little something in case you tire of your smelly old pipe." They waited as the attendants transferred Cabrillo to the gurney and lifted him inside the ambulance. Then the door was closed and the vehicle moved across the dock. They were standing there watching for a moment until it disappeared onto a street lined with palm trees when a man came up behind them. "Mr. Pitt and Mr. Giordino?" Pitt turned. "That's us." A man in his middle 60s, with gray hair and beard, held up a leather-encased badge and identification. He was wearing white shorts, a flowered silk shirt, and sandals. "I've been sent by my superiors to take you to the airport. An aircraft is waiting to fly you to Washington." "Aren't you a little old to play secret agent?" said Giordino, studying the stranger's identification. "We oldies but goodies can often pass unnoticed where you younger guys can't." "Which way to your car?" asked Pitt conversationally. The senior citizen pointed to a small Toyota van painted in the wild colors of a local taxi. "Your carriage awaits." "I had no idea the CIA cut your budget so drastically," Giordino said sarcastically. "We make do with what we've got." They piled into the van, and 20 minutes later they were seated in a military cargo jet. As the plane rolled down the runway of Guam's Air Force Base, Pitt looked out the window and saw the senior intelligence agent leaning against his van, as if confirming that Pitt and Giordino had departed the island. In another minute, they were flying above the often overlooked island paradise of the Pacific, with its volcanic mountains, lush jungle waterfalls, and miles of white sand beaches graced with swaying cocoa palms. The Japanese swarmed into the hotels and onto the beaches of Guam, but not many Americans. He continued staring down as the plane passed over the turquoise waters inside the reef surrounding the island and headed out to sea. As Giordino dozed off, Pitt turned his thoughts to the United States, sailing somewhere on the ocean below him. Something terrible was in the works, a terrible threat that only one man on Earth could prevent. But Pitt knew with crystallized certainty that nothing, except perhaps an untimely death, would deflect Chin Shang from his purpose. The world may be a place that is scarce of honest politicians, white buffalo, unpolluted rivers, saints, and miracles, but there is no shortage of depraved villains. Some, like serial killers, may slay 20 or 100 innocent victims. But given financial resources, they might kill many more. Those like Chin Chang, who possessed enormous affluence, could hold themselves above the law and hire homicidal cretins to do their dirty work for them. The evil billionaire was not a general who felt remorse over losing 1,000 men in battle to achieve an objective. Chin Chang was a cold-blooded sociopathic murderer who could drink a glass of champagne and eat a hearty dinner after condemning hundreds of illegal immigrants, many of them women and children, to a horrible death in the frigid waters of Orion Lake. Pitt was committed to stopping Chin Chang, whatever the consequences, whatever the cost, even killing him if the occasion presented itself. He was drawn in too deeply to struggle back over the edge. He fantasized what it would be like if they ever met. What would the circumstances be? What would he say to a mass slaughterer? For a long time, Pitt sat there staring up at the cabin ceiling of the aircraft. There was no sense in anything. Whatever Chin Chang's plan had to be, if nothing else, it was mad. And now Pitt's own mind was running amok. There was nothing to do, he thought finally, but to sleep it off, and hope to see things with a sane eye when we reach Washington.